Welcome to Catholic Answers Live, the program where you participate with your questions about apologetics and evangelization, including the most important theological, spiritual, moral, and social issues facing the world today. Call now with your question for today's guest, toll free, 1-888-31-TRUTH. That's 888-318-7884. Now, from San Diego, Catholic Answers Live.
Man, we do Good Friday shows around here. I don't know. It just keeps happening. Week after week, we have great Friday shows. Second hour today, Rose Sweet will be here, and we're going to be discussing happiness and God's plan for your happiness. That's going to be a great one. In this hour, we talk about, well, can you prove that God exists? I am Cy Kellett, your host. And if you could prove that God exists, could you do it in a way that, say, I don't know, a modern person of a scientific mindset could be convinced of it? Our number is 888-318-7884. If you have questions about the ability to prove rationally God's existence, or maybe you want to challenge us on that point, 888-31-TRUTH. Our guest this hour, Edward Fazer. Dr. Fazer is an associate professor of philosophy at Pasadena City College here in California. He's been a visiting assistant professor at Loyola Marymount in Los Angeles and a visiting scholar of at the Social Philosophy and Policy Center at Bowling Green State University. He holds a doctorate in philosophy from the University of California at Santa Barbara. Earlier this year, Dr. Fazer joined us on Catholic Answers Focus for an interview on capital punishment, a topic he covered recently in his book, By Man Shall His Blood Be Shed, A Catholic Defense of Capital Punishment. You can find that interview and other interviews at catholic.com/Focus. His most recent book is Five Proofs for the Existence of God, hence our topic today. Dr. Fazer, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Okay, so can we, in the modern scientific age of, you know, the various insights that we have through biology, chemistry, physics, and all that, can we still say that there's a place for philosophy and that philosophy can, in fact, prove God's existence?
The short answer is yes. I imagine you want a longer answer, so let me try to give that.
Well, let me just express my relief. I'm so glad to hear that the answer was yes. But yeah, if we could have a longer answer.
I guess we're done now, right?
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, so I certainly argue in the book that the answer is yes. And you raise the question of whether the attempt to prove God's existence could still be realized given modern science and so forth. Specifically, that was the context in which you framed the question. And as I argue in the book, the traditional proofs of God's existence, and my book's called Five Proofs of the Existence of God, but they're not my proofs. They're not Fazer's Five Ways or something like that. None of these arguments is original with me. My particular formulation of them is perhaps novel. Mm-hmm. And I deal with objections and answer those objections that the earlier writers who first developed these arguments didn't necessarily address. But nevertheless, the basic thrust of each of the proofs goes back to the very beginnings, most of them to the very beginnings of philosophy. So I'm defending arguments that you first see in writers like Aristotle, in Plotinus, in Thomas Aquinas, in St. Augustine, and in Leibniz, early modern German philosopher Leibniz. As I argue in the book, the foundations of these arguments for God's existence, which I take to be the most compelling arguments, and some of them don't get sufficient attention or even much of any attention in contemporary philosophy, though historically they were regarded as the central arguments. These arguments are grounded in something deeper than natural science. Natural science studies the physical world that we actually have. So biology studies the living things that actually exist and the properties that they actually possess and so forth. Chemistry studies the chemical elements that actually, as the world happens to go, form the building blocks of matter and so forth. But what metaphysics is concerned with, the central branch of philosophy traditionally, what metaphysics and philosophy are concerned with is what must be true of any possible world, any possible physical reality, not just the physical world we actually happen to have. It aims at discovering deeper truths about, for example, what is it to be a cause? What is it for something to undergo change? What is it to be a material object in the first place? And the answers it gives to those questions, the answers that philosophy traditionally gives to those questions, are answers that would have to be true whatever the scientific details turn out to be. The scientific details are secondary compared to the deeper metaphysical truths that philosophy traditionally aims to uncover. And the traditional arguments for God's existence and the ones that I defend in the book are rooted in or grounded in those deeper metaphysical truths, which precisely because they're deeper than anything science can uncover, cannot be overthrown by science either. We've hit sort of intellectual rock bottom when we get to philosophical speculation about the nature of cause and effect or the nature of change and so forth. And it's those premises that the arguments for God's existence are grounded in. So just to give you one example, what I call in the book the Aristotelian proof for God's existence, which naturally has its origins in Aristotle. You even see actually a foreshadowing of it in Plato. And it's developed by later medieval writers like Maimonides and Thomas Aquinas and many others, Arabic philosophers as well. It's grounded in an analysis of the nature of change. And Aristotle and his followers argue that for any change to occur at all, that's possible only if we make a distinction in reality between actuality and potentiality. Change is really just the actualization of a potential. That's a pretty basic idea, but it also has deep philosophical implications. And one of the implications of it that Aristotle argues, Aquinas argues, and I argue in the book, is that we can't make sense of how anything in the world happens at all, any change occurs, or even for that matter, about how any object in the world exists even for a second, unless there's something that actualizes it without itself being actualized. This is what Aristotle and Aquinas meant by God as an unmoved mover, or as I put it in the book, a purely actual actualizer of the world, a cause which actualizes the world at every moment, keeps it in existence from moment to moment to moment to moment, but it does not itself have or require any cause because there's no potentiality in it that needs to be actualized. That's pretty abstract, and I work through this all in the book at, you know, in a very careful, slow, step-by-step way to make it accessible to the novice reader. But the point for our purposes here, in answer to your question, is that the argument is grounded in something deeper than anything that science can either reveal to us or that science could overthrow. It's grounded in what even the scientists have to take for granted.
Do we suffer, though, from some kind of maybe lack of confidence in the mind? That is, that we've become acquainted with proofs that involved instruments and you know, Large Hadron Colliders or microscopes, and there are no instruments that can tell us these things are true or false, and maybe we don't trust the mind to be able to do that unassisted by instruments.
Yeah, there is. I would say there's several intellectual currents in modern culture that have led to skepticism about whether the project of proving God's existence, which most philosophers historically, that was their view, that you could not only give arguments for God's existence, but that you could prove it, you could demonstrate it. I mean, you see this in Aristotle, in Plotinus, in the medieval philosophers, Maimonides, Aquinas, and so on, in early modern philosophers like Leibniz, and so on down the line. It's actually, historically speaking, the mainstream view, which is that God's existence can be demonstrated through pure reason. But in modern times, there's greater skepticism about that, and there's several sources of it. In some contexts, there is indeed what you describe as a loss of confidence in the powers of the mind and a kind of radical skepticism that you see exhibited in postmodernism, for example. In other contexts, though, and in contemporary Anglo-American philosophy, and contemporary analytic philosophy, it's not so much a skepticism about the ability of the mind to know truth, so much as a very narrow conception of what that involves. It's a tendency toward what's called scientism, which is the idea that there's certainly a way to get objective truth, but it's science and only science. And if it's not science, then it's not really respectable. It can't really give us knowledge, or at least any confident knowledge claim about reality. And scientism is one of the targets of my book. And I argue that scientism itself is ultimately, it has a number of problems with it. But one of the problems is it's ultimately a self-undermining position, because scientism, the view that only science gives us knowledge, is not itself a scientific theory. It's a philosophical theory about science, so that even to make the claim and defend the claim that science alone gives us knowledge, you have to appeal to an argumentational basis outside of science, which undermines the whole point of giving the argument. I mean, you have to use a non-scientific argument in order to claim that only scientific arguments are any good. And of course, that's an incoherent project. So scientism ultimately is kind of an intellectual mess, but it's a kind of knee-jerk tendency among many modern philosophers who, they may not doubt the powers of the mind to know reality in general across the board, but they have a very narrow conception of how knowledge works.
888-318-7884 is our number. 888-31-TRUTH. Happy to have your call on whether or not it is, in fact, as Dr. Fazer asserts, possible to prove the existence of God, or that whether that is a worthwhile undertaking, or if you have a particular proof that you have a question about. We welcome all of those questions, comments, challenges. 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live. I am your host, Cy Kellett, and we'll be right back after this.
This is Harry Connick Jr., and you're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Are you coming to the Catholic Answers Conference this September?
You guys put on a great show, so it's well worth coming.
Very powerful, very motivational and moving.
I think it's awesome. It's been really amazing to get to know people from all across the country.
Every time somebody's speaker finishes, I feel like I want to cry just because of how happy I am.
It's been pretty phenomenal. Very educational, enlightening.
This year's conference is September 28th through the 30th here in beautiful San Diego, and we want to see you there. Seats are still available, but act now because they are going fast. Call us today at 1-888-291-8000 or visit CatholicAnswersConference.com now and reserve your spot.
This is where it starts, and it definitely has started for me.
Homeschool Connections, an online provider of courses for your Catholic homeschool, is a sponsor of Catholic Answers Live. Homeschool Connections' website is homeschoolconnections.com.
The Catholic Answers Minute. I'm Father Vincent Serpa. In Matthew 1, we have a genealogy ending with St. Joseph and avoiding any mention of his begetting Jesus. Joseph offers legal paternity, but it is Mary, his betrothed, who begot Jesus. He remained the intimate guardian, teacher, and observer. The parent in the fullest sense is Mary, whose true spouse is God, the Holy Spirit. No other human being has ever been so honored. To say that Catholics overhonor her is to completely disregard the reality of her divine espousal and parenthood. The triune God has honored her far beyond anything Catholics can do. Nevertheless, we do honor her, precisely because of God's direct and unique intervention in her life. Such honor is in response to his deliberate choice and is a mere echo of it. Today we honor the birth of this very special woman. Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners now and at the hour of our death. I'm Father Vincent Serpa for Catholic Answers, Catholic.com.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. We are talking proofs for the existence of God. Dr. Ed Fazer has a brand new book out, Five Proofs for the Existence of God. As he said in the first segment, these are not his proofs, but they are a review and an updating and a re-expression of traditional proofs, proofs that for many centuries were easily accepted, or maybe not easily accepted, but were broadly accepted by most of those who thought about these things. Today, however, we have very deep thinkers who disagree with you, Dr. Fazer. I don't mean to hurt your feelings, but some of the world's great thinkers like Bill Nye, the Science Guy, say we no longer have a need of philosophy. How does one respond to that?
Yes, the formidable Bill Nye, the scientism guy, as I like to think of him, right? So, the problem with that sort of claim that, oh, we don't need philosophy anymore, all we need is science. One of the problems is one I already hinted at before the break, which is that that's itself a philosophical claim. And so, as Etienne Gilson famously said, he said, metaphysics always buries its undertakers. And part of what he meant by that is that any attempt to get rid of philosophy always surreptitiously smuggles in philosophical assumptions.
Right.
Because you've got to give a philosophical argument even to argue that no philosophical arguments are any good. So that's part of the problem with the position that Bill Nye represents. But there are other problems as well, which is that science itself raises both scientific method and scientific results, the actual findings of science, raises philosophical questions that it cannot itself answer, and in some cases cannot answer them even in principle, even in theory. And let me give you one example that I also developed in some detail in the book. Scientific explanation that's understood in modern times, I mean like the last 350 years or so since Descartes and Isaac Newton and guys like that, scientific explanation works by tracing the phenomena of our experience down to laws of nature. The idea is that we can explain the motions of planets, for example, in terms of Kepler's laws of planetary motion. And if someone says, yeah, but how do you explain Kepler's laws? The answer would be, we can show that they follow from deeper laws of nature, like Newtonian mechanics. And then we can show Newtonian mechanics is a special case of Einstein's relativity or something like that. And then so the project is to trace everything that happens down to the most fundamental laws of physics, say. Okay, well, so far, so good, except once we've done that, we've still got a problem. We still have to ask at least two questions. First of all, why is it that the fundamental laws of physics are the ones that we find govern nature rather than some other laws? Or why is the world governed by those laws rather than no laws at all? Why don't we have a purely chaotic world? And secondly, what do we mean by a law of nature in the first place? What is it to be a law of physics? Now, those are both philosophical questions which the scientists cannot answer because scientific method presupposes the idea of a law of nature, a law of physics, so that when you start asking questions about what it is to be a law of nature and why the fundamental laws of nature, the fundamental laws of physics operate, you are, by definition, as it were, transcending or going beyond science and now doing something else, namely philosophy. And there are a number of problems with any attempt to answer this sort of question without doing philosophy. You can't do it without doing philosophy. But just take the very idea, for example, of the question of what do we mean by a law of nature? I mean, do we mean we say something is a law of physics that there was a cosmic legislature that passed it and there was a cosmic executive who – well, that's not what we mean, obviously. So what do we mean? Well, what the early modern scientists, people like Isaac Newton and Descartes, meant by laws of nature is they meant – they had a theological idea of laws. The way they understood it is a law of physics – is essentially a decree by God. Here's how matter shall work, right? Here's how, it's like God's telling the material world, here are your marching orders. Here's how I want you to operate. I call it, you know, Newtonian physics or whatever. Now, later thinkers, of course, abandoned the idea that a law of nature is a literal divine decree, a literal piece of legislation by God, right, by a divine legislator. And instead, they substitute some other idea. So, for example, David Hume, early modern philosopher, he thinks of laws of nature as something like just regularities. To say it's a law of nature that if you let go of an object, it'll fall to the ground, just to take a very simplified statement of gravity, right, is just to say that that's the way the world happens to work, right? And we don't know why. That's just the way the world happens to work. That's called a regularity theory of laws of nature. Now, one problem with that understanding of what a law of nature is that if that's what a law of nature is, then laws of physics don't really explain anything anymore. All they do is add a fancy new label to what it is we try to explain. If I say, gee, I let things go and they keep falling, why is that? That's a regular pattern we find in the world. Why does the world operate that way? And someone says, well, because it's a law of physics, call it gravity, right? And then I say, oh, that's interesting. What do you mean by a law of physics? And he answers, oh, what I mean by calling it a law of physics is that's just the regular pattern we find. We've gone around in a circle, exactly. We haven't really explained anything. We've just attached a fun new label, law, to the phenomena we were supposed to be explaining. So then you might try some other alternative law of physics, account of what a law of nature is or a law of physics. But the problem is anytime you try to do it, you're really doing philosophy and you're not doing science anymore. Because you're dealing with what science itself presupposes. And this is well known to philosophers of science, and it's also used to be well known to scientists of an earlier generation, people of Einstein's generation or Schrödinger or Heisenberg or people like that. They knew enough philosophy to know that their very discipline made assumptions that they could not justify or examine, that they had to rely on philosophy to do that. But modern intellectual life has become so hyper-specialized, you could spend your whole life just doing, you know, cell biology or something, or ichthyology, and never think about a philosophical question, that many modern scientists don't realize how deeply indebted they are to certain philosophical assumptions. They don't realize they're doing philosophy without realizing it when they pontificate on science. And then when you get to someone like Bill Nye, who's really more of a kind of a science publicist, kind of a science journalist, rather than a scientist in the strict sense, then, you know, you even got, it's kind of a second or third hand kind of bad or unselfconscious philosophizing. That's just one example, and I could give others, and I do in the book, of how science really makes philosophical assumptions that it can't itself justify. So this idea that, oh, we don't need philosophy anymore, is really quite naive and ill-informed.
Five Proofs for the Existence of God is the name of the book. The author with us today, Dr. Edward Faser. Our number, 888-318-7884. Lots of calls on this topic, so we'll go to the phones. Jeff in Peoria, Illinois, listening on 94.3 FM. You are on with Dr. Edward Faser. What's your question?
Hi, Doc. Thanks for taking my call. I find your definition of scientism interesting. Quite often when I have a discussion with this about my students, you know, they come at me with the assumption that science can answer any question. And if it can't, that it's only a matter of time before it does. And usually I'll return with the idea of, well, what happens after you die? And the response is almost always, well, I don't know, but I do know that you don't go to heaven. So how does, a post-death experience play into your argument for God? Does that make sense?
Yeah, sure. So I think I could say there are two questions that you raised in your comments, so I'll try to address them in order. And the first one was this assumption that you find among your students that any question can be answered scientifically, and if it hasn't been happened yet, then it'll happen at some point, right? And so I already in my earlier comments said a little bit about that, because that essentially presupposes scientism, that science is the only avenue of knowledge. And I should clarify, by the way, in case any listener misunderstands, I'm certainly not denying that science gives us genuine knowledge. I'm not saying anything that is hostile towards science. All I'm saying is that science, even though it's definitely an avenue of knowledge, it's not the only avenue of knowledge. Okay, with that qualification out of the way, you know, one of the things I would say to people who raise comments like the ones your students did is, you know, I make points I made earlier by giving examples of philosophical questions that science raises, but that it doesn't itself answer. But another thing I would do is I would put the burden of proof, I'd put the onus on them. If they're going to say that only science gives us knowledge, and that if a question is going to be answered, it's going to be answered eventually by science or not at all, I would ask them, well, how do they know that? What's the basis for their making that claim about science? And I would challenge them to give some argument in support of that that doesn't itself end up making non-scientific assumptions, making assumptions that science itself doesn't answer or doesn't justify. And I submit that they will not be able to do it. But the exercise of even trying to do it and finding that, you know, any attempt they give to give a scientific argument for the claim that science alone gives us knowledge, they're going to find they keep making assumptions that go beyond anything science can tell us. And perhaps that will, you know, set off ring a bell in them that maybe actually they're too confident in this idea that science alone gives us knowledge. So that's one point I would make. Now, you also raised the question about how the question of life after death enters into the argument of the book. And I guess the answer is it doesn't. That I would say that's a separate question. Now, sometimes people do appeal to the idea of life after death. For example, they might appeal to evidence for near-death experiences as evidence of an afterlife and thus indirectly evidence for God's existence. That happens to be a line of argument that I don't address in the book. It's not one of the five proofs that I refer to in the title of the book. And while I'm not necessarily, you know, I wouldn't sort of just rule out from the get-go an argument of that type, my own opinion is that the most fundamental and persuasive and powerful arguments for God's existence are ones that bracket off the question of life after death. You could be convinced that God exists, whether or not you go on to believe that there's such a thing as an afterlife. Those are logically independent questions. I might note, for example, that Antony Flew, a very prominent 20th century atheist philosopher, in the last couple of years or so of his life, he ended up changing his mind about atheism. He gave up atheism. And one of the reasons why he gave it up is he said that he'd been led to reconsider arguments of Aristotle, and I happen to defend Aristotle's argument for God's existence in my own book, but Antony Flew said that it was in part a reconsideration of Aristotle's argument for God's existence, which he said, you know, he'd been a philosopher of great renown for decades. He said he'd never really considered any detail before. That's pretty telling, but in any event, toward the end of Flew's life, as I say, he was convinced in part by Aristotle's argument that God existed. But Flew never gave up his doubt that there was any afterlife. He still denied there was life after death. even though he came to believe in God. So those are independent questions. You can treat the one without addressing the other.
We're going to have to take a quick break. Jeff, thank you very much for that call. Lots of other calls on the line. 888-318-7884, our number. Dr. Edward Faser, our guest. We're talking proofs of God on Catholic Answers Live, and we'll be right back.
EWTN, communicating the faith.
And all the people who are working so hard to get us on radio, you know, that's wonderful. It's not that expensive, I don't think. And even if you reach 100 miles or 50 miles, you help spread the word. And we do all the programming for you. Programming is the expensive stuff, you know, so you don't have to worry about programming. And so we want to thank you for everything you've done to make this radio possible.
Hello, my friends. This is Catholic Answers President Christopher Check, and I'm here to tell you about a unique resource just out from Catholic Answers Press. One of the ways Jesus answered his critics was to use their own words against them, showing how even the enemies of the faith admitted crucial facts that undermined their own positions. And it's been that way through the ages. It's proved impossible for those out to destroy the faith to mount their attacks without tripping themselves up and inadvertently testifying to the truth of what they're trying to destroy. In his new book, Hostile Witnesses, How the Historic Enemies of the Church Prove Christianity, renowned author Gary Machuda looks at dozens of Christianity's most notorious foes from biblical times to the present day and draws from their antagonistic words and deeds surprising testimony to gospel truths. Rich in research and written with clarity and force, Hostile Witnesses is a unique contribution to Catholic apologetics and one that speaks with special urgency to a modern world in which the faith is under attack like never before. If you love apologetics, you need to order your copy of Hostile Witnesses today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at catholic.com, or asking for this book at a Catholic bookstore in your area.
Having another fun Friday here on Catholic Answers Live. Rose Sweet, up next. Next hour, we're going to talk about happiness and whether the church wants you to be happy or not. I bet there are people who will say, no, the church doesn't want you to be happy. We'll see what Rose says, but I think she's going to come down on the yes side on that one and help us with what the church can do to help you to be happy. This hour, we're talking God. Dr. Edward Faser has a new book out, Five Proofs for the Existence of God. And as we've said a couple times, they are not his proofs, but he does update them so they are accessible to the modern reader. And we are discussing those. We go now to Matt in North Platte, Nebraska, listening on Spirit Radio. Matt, thanks for being with us. What's your question for Dr. Faser?
Hi, my question was, I was reading an article the other day that said basically we need to be careful about using St. Thomas Aquinas' proofs for the existence of God because they're somewhat incomplete in that they don't prove that there's necessarily just one God. So I was wondering whether you agreed with that, and if so, how we could shore those up to prove that they indicate just one God.
Yeah, I happen not to agree with that, and though Aquinas's the five arguments that I defend in the book, only I would say two of them are ones you see in Thomas Aquinas. But I have I do defend at least those two in the book, and I've defended all of Aquinas's five ways elsewhere in my book on Aquinas, for example. But what I would say, and it's a big topic, Aquinas's five ways. But one of the things I would say is that the arguments of Aquinas's five ways are very widely misunderstood because people read them out of context in a way that Aquinas did not intend. So they occupy a pretty short space in the Summa Theologiae. It's only like a couple pages in a modern edition. What happens is that modern readers tend to read just those two pages or so, and they read them out of context, and they think that what Aquinas meant with the five ways was to give you kind of a one-stop shopping set of arguments for God's existence, as if, you know, like I sometimes joke with my students, you know, that people think that in Aquinas' view, if you just left the five ways on a bus and an atheist walked on and read them, then he'd get off the bus and be a believer in God suddenly. You know, as if Aquinas meant the arguments to be, you know, everything that he had to say all in one little package. And that's not true. the five ways were only meant to be summaries of arguments that Aquinas develops in much more detail elsewhere. And they were also summaries of arguments that would have been well known to readers of his day. I compare them to encyclopedia articles. If you read an encyclopedia entry on quantum mechanics or on special relativity theory or on evolution, you're not getting the whole story. You're just getting a brief summary, and a summary that doesn't address every question that a skeptic might raise. And that's how the five ways are as well. They're just meant to be summaries. And a lot of the detail, including the argumentation for why there must be only one uncaused cause of the world, why this uncaused cause has to be all-powerful, all-knowing, outside of time and space, etc. Aquinas does give many detailed arguments for all those claims, but he does so elsewhere other than in the body of the five ways themselves. And I think all those arguments are very powerful, and I defend them at length, some of them I defend in this new book of mine, Five Proofs of the Existence of God. But so I would disagree with the premise of the question, though in fairness to the caller, it is a very widely held assumption that Aquinas' five ways somehow are incomplete, or they fail to do the job they're meant to do. But that's not in fact the case, because Aquinas meant them only as summaries of lines of argument he develops in detail elsewhere in his work.
Does that work for you, Matt?
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you very much for that call, Matt. 888-318-7884, our number. Edward in Tulsa, Oklahoma, listening on 94.9 FM. Edward, your question for Dr. Fazer.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm enjoying your show. I'd like to ask you, do you think that a number of the occurrences in the biologic world require the existence of God? For example, in human cell division, we have two types. One is called mitosis, and another is meiosis. And in mitosis, the cell duplicates its genetic material and divides such that each daughter cell has a full complement of genetic information. Whereas, and that's in the vast majority of the cells in the body, except for a small population of cells, the sex cells, the gonads, the ovary and sperm. And what they do is they go through a process of meiosis, where in cellular division, the genetic material is divided in half. And then at fertilization, the new cell that's created has a full complement of genetic information. And to think that that could have come about through a process of random variation, if there was a mutation that left one organism that was capable of meiosis, it just defies logic, because where would it find a mate that could undergo meiosis? And then there are also so many examples of proteins in the body that are very complex three-dimensional structures, that as these three-dimensional molecules rotate and change their conformation, they have a variety of opposing activities. On the one hand, the same molecule may cause your blood to be thin, and another may cause it to clot. And it all depends on how this molecule rotates and exposes different parts of the molecule.
Am I right, Edward, in thinking that what you're arguing there is that these things in nature seem to suggest, not just suggest, but you're saying would prove that God must have made these things, because in your way of understanding it, nature itself, through random selection, for example, could not have done this. Is that the point that you're making for Dr. Fazer?
I don't want to use the term intelligent design, but I would say that it requires a God.
Okay, let's let Dr. Fazer respond to that. What is your view on that, Dr. Fazer?
Yeah, well, what the caller is talking about here is basically the kind of argument for God's existence that begins with a consideration of very specific physical phenomena, in this case, biological phenomena, and argues that they have not been given a scientific explanation, and that maybe current scientific theory like Darwinian evolution cannot account for them, say, and then argues for God as a cause of those phenomena. Now, that kind of argument is often called the design argument for God's existence. It's associated with William Paley. I think the caller said he wouldn't necessarily use the label intelligent design for that kind of argument, though it is the kind of argument that intelligent design writers often make use of. In my case, though, it's, for one thing, it's not the sort of argument I defend in my book, Five Proofs of the Existence of God. It's just not on the list of the five. But that's not really an accident or a lack of space. I'm not myself a big fan of that style of argument. Part of the reason has to do with details of the way that sort of argument goes. But I would say the deepest reason is that I think that the most powerful and fundamental and central arguments for God's existence, they're not arguments from unusual phenomena, like this or that specific aspect of the natural world. They're rather arguments from the most common and obvious and uncontroversial phenomena. So if you look at Aquinas' arguments, for example, some of which I defend in the book, the fact that there's any change in the world at all itself leads you unavoidably to the existence of an unmoved mover or unchangeable changer of the world. Or the fact that anything exists at all, even for a second, leads inexorably to the conclusion that there must be an uncaused cause who causes things to exist from moment to moment to moment. And that sort of argument has nothing to do with specific details of science that might end up being overthrown. When you focus on those sorts of considerations, like the structure of the cell or what have you, you're always in danger of giving what's called a God of the gaps argument, that you're appealing to evidence that science hasn't maybe yet explained, but in theory and principle could. In which case, you're just using God to plug a current gap in scientific knowledge, and your argument for God's existence is therefore at the mercy of the scientific developments of the next 20 years or 100 years or what have you. The arguments that I give in the book and the arguments that you see in the most important philosophers historically who've argued for God, Aristotle, Plotinus, Thomas Aquinas, Leibniz, etc., they're not like that. They start with premises that any possible science would have to take for granted, and so no possible science could overthrow. And those, I think, are the most powerful sorts of arguments for God's existence. And I tend to think that focusing on specific weird or unusual phenomena in nature, you know, the bacterial flagellum or the structure of the cell, my view tends to be that that's a distraction. And it makes the arguments for God's existence seem dependent on current scientific knowledge in a way they really aren't.
Edward, thank you very, very much for that question. We appreciate that call. I hope that was, in fact, helpful to you. That seems like a very sensible path to rely on what's common. I wonder, as you were speaking, I was thinking about the person who cannot, because of they're not trained to, or they don't have the leisure time to, or master proofs for the existence of God. Do you, as a philosopher, find it acceptable for someone to say, I do believe in God based on my experience, my intuitions, all these kinds of things, and not be familiar with proofs or not have proofs to back that belief up?
I don't think that's necessarily a problem at all, any more than the fact that, say, the average person cannot explain to you how the optical system works. He can't explain to you how the eyeball works or how the optic nerve works or how the brain processes visual information. That doesn't make the average person somehow irrational for trusting his eyeballs, right?
So I see,
and,
yeah.
And everybody acknowledges this. They admit that. They even the most hard-nosed atheists would acknowledge that. Not everyone has to be an expert on how the eye works or how the optic nerve works in order to be justified in trusting what his senses tell him. And in the same way, I certainly would not say that every religious person has to be able to give you some fancy philosophical argument in order to justify his belief in God. So I think that's perfectly fine when people don't give philosophical arguments. But I think someone somewhere should be able to give them. I think of it as kind of an intellectual division of labor, that just like not everybody has to be a biologist or a cognitive scientist, but somebody had better be able to do that work to explain how our optical system works. In the same way, not everybody has to be a philosopher or to be able to give fancy arguments for God's existence, but someone ought to be able to do that. And that job falls to philosophers and theologians, and traditionally it was done by philosophers and theologians. So someone has to do it, but not everybody has to do it, I guess would be my short answer.
Fair enough. We'll have to take another quick break. We'll be right back. Lots of calls. So we'll get to callers. Hang on. We'll get to you when we come back right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Miss a show? Make sure to catch up by downloading the podcast, available online at Catholic.com.
Catholic Bibles contain several books that aren't found in Protestant Bibles, and controversy has swirled around these books for hundreds of years. Protestant apologists often make charges like Catholics have violated God's word by adding books to the Bible. Jesus and the apostles didn't honor these extra Catholic books. The New Testament never quotes these books, or the books contain clear historical and theological errors. Such arguments can catch Catholics flat-footed, leaving them not knowing how to understand. But now, Catholic Answers is coming out with a brand new edition of apologist Gary Machuda's classic work, Why Catholic Bibles Are Bigger. In this new and improved edition, Gary exposes many commonly held myths and uncovers little-known and surprising facts concerning these books that Protestant Bibles have lost. Developing and distributing informative resources like Why Catholic Bibles Are Bigger is the kind of effort your generosity makes possible. To make your donation and to get a free copy of Why Catholic Bibles Are Bigger, visit Catholic.com and click the Why Catholic Bibles Are Bigger banner, or call us toll-free at 888-291-8000. That's the Why Catholic Bibles Are Bigger banner at Catholic.com, or call toll-free 888-291-8000.
Catholic Answers Live is brought to you in part by CatholicSingles.com, the website for Catholics who want to meet others who share their faith and values for faith, fellowship, and love. You can learn more at CatholicSingles.com. Catholic Answers Live thanks CatholicSingles.com for their generous support.
You've heard that St. Paul Street Evangelization supports hundreds of teams of evangelists sharing the good news. But did you know that some of these teams are public prayer stations? Set up a sign on the sidewalk and offer prayer and encouragement to those you encounter. Everyone needs prayer. Try this new method of witnessing to Jesus. Contact St. Paul Street Evangelization to get started at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Call now with your question. 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Talking God on this Friday afternoon, Friday evening, depending on where you are, with Dr. Edward Faser, whose latest book, Five Proofs for the Existence of God, gives us the grist for the mill today. 888-318-7884, our number. And as I said, there are a lot of callers on the line, so we'll try to work through them quickly this segment. And I go to Philip in Inglewood, California, listening on Immaculate Art Radio. Philip, your question for Dr. Faser.
Well, I have three propositions I'll throw out to you. I believe that I can demonstrate beyond doubt that it is not unreasonable to believe that life may come again after it has passed away, that Dr. Faser may come to live again after he has passed away. I'm not saying that I prove the existence of afterlife, only that you cannot argue that I am being unreasonable.
Okay.
So why, if I'm not being unreasonable, why do you want to argue with my reasonableness? The second one is, I think you can maybe prove the existence of God, or one of the proofs, by what I call a relational theory. The third is, I think that theologically speaking, and not philosophically speaking, from God's eyes, and those are the only eyes that count, a fertilized ovum is an adult human person at the same instant it is a fertilized ovum. In other words, God sees the human person in all its segments of development
at once.
Since time. Pardon?
Okay, at once. I don't think we're just not going to have time for all three of them, Philip, so I have to ask you. First of all, I'm very happy that none of them were indecent proposals. Every single one of those was a decent proposal, probably a reasonable proposal. But you got to pick one. Maybe you could tell us why you believe you can't prove, but you can give us evidence that it's reasonable to believe in life after death.
Okay, ask the doctor to answer this question. Which of these two is the more mysterious, the more fantastic, the more wondrous, that life should have come in the first place, or that life having come and passed away should come again? Which of those two is the more unlikely, the more fantastic, the more wondrous, the more unexplainable?
I don't have to ask him. You just asked him. I just have to let him answer.
Yeah, well, I guess I'd want to think about the specific way that the caller framed the question, but maybe it would suffice if I said this, that I actually agree with the caller that the existence of the afterlife is something that we can be reasonable in believing in. In fact, I would go beyond that. I think that the existence of the afterlife is something that can be philosophically demonstrated. And here I'm in a tradition of thought that goes back to Plato and that goes back to Thomas Aquinas. And just as I would defend the traditional proofs of God's existence, and I would defend the very ambitious claims that that older philosophers made for them, I would make the same claim for the arguments for the immortality of the soul. In fact, that's a book project that's two books away that I intend to work on arguments for the immortality of the soul. But perhaps I don't know if the caller raised the question because of what I said earlier in the interview, but I certainly didn't mean to deny earlier that the existence of the afterlife is something that we could be reasonable in believing. And indeed, as I said, I think you can demonstrate the existence of the immortality of the soul. My point was just that that's an issue you could bracket off for purposes of arguing for God's existence. In other words, even if it turned out that we had no good reason to believe in an afterlife, it wouldn't follow that you couldn't demonstrate God's existence. Those are separate questions, and I address them separately, and I don't address the afterlife question in the book. I just focus on arguments for God's existence.
Philip, I hope that that's helpful to you. I wish we did have time, in fact, to go through all the propositions, but we don't, because we have full lines and we have just a few minutes left. So we will move on, and thank you for that call, Philip. Frank in Manhasset, New York, listening on CatholicAnswers.com. Your question for Dr. Fazer.
Oh, that's great. Thank you very much. Dr. Fazer, I think your books are terrific. I think you've done a great service for everyone. And Cy, I think you're terrific as well. But Aquinas referenced, I think, Averroes or Avicenna. He wasn't convinced by the Kalam argument. I happen to think it's reasonable. Could you explain why he didn't agree with it?
Sure, and let me just start by thanking you for your very kind words. I really do appreciate that. I guess I should start by mentioning for other listeners that what the caller is asking about, which is called the Kalam argument these days for the existence of God, and it's not an argument Aquinas defends, and it's not an argument I defend in my book either. That's the sort of argument that argues that an infinitely old universe is impossible, that the universe must have had a beginning, and that God is the cause of that beginning. Some callers might be surprised to learn that that's not an argument Aquinas accepts. And in fact, none of the arguments that I defend in my book are arguments for a beginning of the universe. And that's a key, a very important point to emphasize, that the arguments I defend and the arguments that you see in Aristotle and Thomas Aquinas and many others are not attempts to prove the world had a beginning. They're rather attempts to show that whether the world had a beginning or not, the fact that it exists here and now, even for a second, would be impossible if God were not continuously causing the world, as it were. So Aquinas doesn't trace the series of causes backward in time to a Big Bang. Rather, he traces it, you might say, downward here and now to a foundation, as it were, on which all of reality rests at every moment, traces it downward to an uncaused cause who's causing the world here and now. So the caller asks, why doesn't Aquinas defend the sort of argument that we're talking about for a beginning of the universe? And a detailed answer gets a little complicated, but Aquinas distinguishes between two kinds of cause and effect series, and I kind of alluded to them just now. One of them is sometimes called a linear cause and effect series that traces forward and backward into the past, and another one is a hierarchical sort of causal series that traces upward or downward here and now simultaneously at every moment. And it's that second kind of series, the simultaneous or hierarchical causal series, that Aquinas thinks in the nature of the case must have a first member or the series couldn't exist at all. The reason is that the members of that series are like, and here I borrow Aquinas's example or illustration of the point, they're like the hand which pushes the stick which pushes a stone. A stick can push a stone, but not under its own steam. It can do it only if it borrows power from the hand to move the stone. So if you don't have, something like an unmoved mover, someone like a person who can move a stick and through the stick move a stone, but no one's picking him up in order to do that, if you didn't have a first mover in a series like that, then you wouldn't have a series at all. But the kind of cause and effect series that traces forward and backward in time, which is called a linear sort of causal series, or Aquinas calls an accidentally ordered causal series. I discuss this in some detail in the book. He doesn't think that sort of series necessarily has to have a first member. He gives the example of a father begetting a son who in turn begets a grandson. So suppose Bob begets Frank and Frank begets George and so forth. If Bob has this son Frank and then Bob dies out, Frank has built-in causal power to have a son of his own. He doesn't need Bob still around to do it. And so you don't have to trace the operation of that kind of cause and effect series, the kind that extends forward and backward in time, to a first member who's operating here and now. So for that reason, Aquinas thought that the kind of cause and effect series that goes forward and backward in time, at least in theory, it might not have a first member. But he doesn't think that matters for arguing for God's existence, because that's not the kind of cause and effect series he cares about. He instead cares about the kind that traces downward here and now to a first cause who's operating here and now to keep the world going at any second. So the reason has to do with the nature of the two kinds of cause and effect series. And Aquinas not only doesn't endorse the Kalam argument, he's actually pretty adamant that, you know, he thought Christian philosophers and theologians shouldn't defend that sort of argument, because he thought it was kind of a red herring or a distraction. He even wrote a whole book, a short book, but still a whole book, arguing that whether the universe had a beginning can't be proven philosophically. We could only know that through the Bible and not through philosophy. So he thought theologians and philosophers shouldn't waste time on that, as he saw. I think that's a little harsh. I think it's a little strong, but he was pretty adamant on that position.
Frank?
You think with the advent of the Bordovalenko-Guth theorem that he would have agreed with it?
No, I don't think so, because I don't think that anything, if what you're asking is, would he think that anything in modern cosmology and astronomy and physics would gives us reason to reconsider the Kalam argument? I don't think he would, and I think it's because of his understanding of the nature of time and the nature of causality. And in other words, he's appealing to premises that are more fundamental than anything physics or the other sciences give us. So I don't think he would change his mind based on that. You'd have to, if you wanted to convince Thomas, you'd have to give him some philosophical argument that showed him that he was somehow drawing incorrect conclusions from his understanding of time and causality.
Got to move on, Frank, because there are a lot of callers. Thank you very much for that call. We go now to Linda in St. Louis, Missouri, listening on Covenant Radio. Linda, your question for Dr. Edward Fazer.
Dr. Fazer, this is a simple question from a beginner in philosophy, but it seems to me that maybe science and philosophy are answering different questions, the one how and the other why. For example, how was the world created? Okay, the Big Bang Theory. Why was the world created? Or take a human being, the science of the human being from conception through birth and so on. Science tells us how these things happen, but it's only philosophy that can tell us why. Your comment, sir.
Thank you for your comment. And I think there's a lot of truth in that. Though I guess I would qualify it. I think science certainly doesn't tell us why. It doesn't answer questions about purpose, or what philosophers call teleology, or final causes, to use the technical jargon. And the reason has to do with the very nature of scientific method. I mean, especially physics, which is highly mathematical in character, given its way of modeling the world mathematically, it kind of rules out any consideration of purpose. So it only deals with how and not with why. I agree with you about that. But I would go beyond that. I would say that science doesn't even tell you everything about how the world works, let alone why. It tells you a lot, but it doesn't tell you the most fundamental things, such as why an object, a physical object, continues in existence even for a moment rather than blinking out, or how it's possible for anything to have any power to cause other things. And it's the answers that philosophy gives to those questions that are the starting points for arguments for God's existence, like the ones I defend in the book.
All right, we'll have to leave it there. Linda, thank you very much for that call. We'll look two books down the line for your book on the immortality of the soul. You got to finish the book on carburetor repair and then the one on Emily Browning, and then we get that book. Thank you very much, Dr. Fazer.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.